basic ideas of quantum mechanics. So, Happy New Year. This is the 1st of January, 2007, and you have exactly 4 weeks before the General 1 exam. So at this point, whether you've been following a half hour a day or just started with the Hurry Up session a week ago or 2 weeks ago or just starting out now, what you really need to have in front of you is a really clear idea of what you need to work on. And this should have been gleaned from reviewing notes and textbooks and from reviewing the problem on past General 1 exams. So I'm going to be assuming that you really have order 10 pages of notes to yourself about what you need to work on. And you need to look at this list very carefully now and divide the questions you have into two categories. The first category, which is really the important one, are those things which really deal with core physics questions. Things like, how do we know that energy is quantized? What's the basic idea of the equivalence principle? Why do we believe de Broglie? Things like that. Things that you will resolve by reading about them and pondering them and understanding them. The other things are sort of failures of execution, that you don't know how to do a certain kind of integral, that you're nearly not sure how to show that a set of orthogonal functions are orthogonal, how to invert a matrix, procedural things that get in the way. Those are really less important. They're not mathematical tricks, but they're ideas that you can pick up. And these are the things that you'll solve by working problems. But the thing you really need to pay attention to are the core physics ideas that maybe you don't understand so well. Because if you're going to be a physicist, you need to really work on these things. And you'll be working on them for the rest of your life. Just in looking at quantum mechanics things tonight, I kind of learned a lot. And you will always be, if you're good, you will always be relearning the cornerstone ideas of physics. And you're going to start now. So in the coming week, you should identify, you know, roughly a quarter of those things and get the appropriate texts and read up on them and think about them and talk about them with colleagues. A good thing to do now is to try to find a few other people to work with. And it's probably best to work for an hour or two and then spend a lot of time on your own. Long study sessions as a group are not, I find, terribly productive, although it's different for different people. Regarding texts, in trying to understand something, I find it's usually better to find one book and really try to understand the treatment in that book rather than shopping around and reading the same thing in many different textbooks. If you used Griffiths and you're happy with it, look in that. I put a list of books that I like on the website. In addition, for quantum mechanics, there's Sakurai and the book by Schiff, which is arguably the best quantum mechanics book. There's also Landau's book, which is a lot of people find hard to understand. Anyway, what you really need to be doing to grasp the basic ideas is not just working problems. You need to be reading and thinking and talking to people. Talk to your professors, your advisor, send me an email. don't look on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is just filled with mistakes. But try to find some means of getting your questions answered, because this is really the core of this whole process in preparing for General One. This week we're going to talk about the basic ideas of quantum mechanics, and they're actually going to be, the next three lectures are going to be about, primarily about quantum mechanics. This week we're going to talk about some of the basic ideas, and then next week will be devoted to the hydrogen atom, which you really need to know in detail, and we'll include in that perturbation theory and radiative transitions. And then the week after that will be two-state systems, which is, again, another thing that you really need to know in some detail. And in two-state systems, we'll also cover some aspects of perturbation theory, NMR, more about the Stern-Gerlach experiment, and so on. So this week we're just going to sort of begin by talking about some of the simplest ideas of quantum mechanics. Of course, quantum mechanics started with the idea that energy is quantized, which was originally introduced by Planck and brought in Planck's constant. The basic idea Planck had was to apply statistical mechanics, which had been applied by people like Maxwell to atoms, to the radiation field. And he needed something to enforce the idea that the radiation field was discrete in the same way atoms were, which led him to think of the idea that there would be individual packets of quantized energy. And from there, he was able to use the formulation of statistical mechanics by Maxwell, which we talked about last week, to show that, in fact, there was no ultraviolet catastrophe and that the black body spectrum was a continuous spectrum with a single maximum and integrable. And from there, he was able to show the Stefan-Boltzmann law, which related the radiative power output from a black body to the fourth power of the temperature. That done, the next big ideas came pretty quickly, involving de Broglie, who, working by analogy to the photon or the electromagnetic quanta, put forward the idea that matter, i.e. things with mass, would have momenta that was related to a wavelength, so that P is Planck's constant divided by the wavelength lambda. And around the same time, Heisenberg, considering the ideas of measurement of momenta and coordinate, or energy and time, in more generally speaking, canonically conjugate coordinates. So these are coordinates that have non-zero Poisson brackets. Came up with the uncertainty relationship, delta P times delta X is greater than H-bar, or H-bar over 2. And around the same time, the Stern-Gerlach experiments were carried out, which showed that angular momentum was quantized, and that a spin one-half system would be either spin up or spin down. a little bit earlier, Bohr had formulated the Bohr model of the atom, and this had led, in combination with the other things I've mentioned, to the idea of wave mechanics, culminating in Schrödinger's equation, where a free particle is described by a wave function psi, which is a function of spatial coordinate x, with the interpretation that psi star psi gave the probability of being of the particle being at x, assuming that psi was properly normalized, and that the time development of the wave function, the time derivative, I h bar d psi dt, would be equal to minus h bar squared over 2m del squared psi plus v, a potential acting on psi, which is Schrödinger's equation. The development of this was very long and elaborate, and is admirably described in Max Jammer's book, The Conceptual Development of Quantum Mechanics, and really doesn't need to concern us here. What we want to think about are the basic ideas that matter are waves and describable by a wave equation. So a wave equation of the form constant A times e to the I phi, where phi is a phase, and the phase is related to the momentum via the wavelength and the energy via a frequency. What is important in all of this is not being able to outline the historical development, but being able to make use of the basic ideas in order to solve problems. So a first problem to think about is the Stern-Gerlach experiment. The idea of the Stern-Gerlach experiment was silver atoms have an intrinsic angular momentum described completely by the single valence electron. So the angular momentum is one Bohr magneton. And a beam of silver atoms from an oven, so the oven is heated to some temperature T, the silver atoms have some energy, 3/2 k Boltzmann T, and have some velocity that's equal to the square root of E divided by 2m. These atoms, or I guess 2e divided by m, sorry. So these atoms emerge from this oven and are collimated by a system of slits to make a beam. And the beam has no particular polarization, but is directed through an inhomogeneous magnetic field. The energy of a magnetic dipole mu in a field B is minus mu dot B. So the force, if along the z direction, for example, is dz, the derivative, partial derivative of mu dot B with respect to z, since mu is the magnetic moment of the atom, then one must have a spatially B that varies along Z. So a beam passing through a length of magnet L will feel a net momentum impulse, which is equal to the force times L divided by V, which is just the time it takes to go through that magnetic region. So there will be a net momentum impulse, or delta P, along Z, up or down depending on the spin. So the beam is analyzed into two beams, one spin up, one spin down. So typical general one problem would be to ask you to work this out numerically. One can stack up a whole series of Stern-Gerlach experiments and do two state systems. So for example, the Stern-Gerlach experiment I just described is oriented along Z. If we take the velocity vector of the beam to be pointed along y. We could have another Stern-Gerlach apparatus, which would just act on one of the beams. You block the other beam. The spin-down beam, for example, is blocked, so now you have a beam of spin-up, or up is along the z-axis. Put that through a Stern-Gerlach apparatus oriented along x, and see what you get. You, of course, get a superposition of the two states quantized along x, and then you can put another Stern-Gerlach apparatus, again, oriented along z, and you get back a spin-down along z component. And so it would be reasonable to expect you to be able to, number one, define a system of basis kets for spin up and spin down in the various coordinate systems, and then be able to write at each stage of that apparatus the superposition of the correct basis kets to give the wave function, or the superposition ket at each stage. And that's something that you should really just absolutely know. Of course, diffraction patterns of electrons going through slits and how wide the slits need to be based on the uncertainty principle is also an important thing to be able to work out. Another good problem to make sure that you understand the uncertainty principle is the old problem of balancing a pencil on its point. This has to do with how accurately you can position the point of the pencil in order to achieve balance, and how positioning at a certain precision introduces a momentum uncertainty, and what the longest you could ever hope to get a pencil to stay up for is a good problem to work through. Now, one thing to be a little cautious of is making sure that you understand the Bra-Ket notation. The Bra-Ket notation was developed by Dirac. Its origins are actually a little bit obscure, but what you want to understand is this. So just think about a ket. A ket is a line and a greater than sign, and in between the line and greater than sign, you put some label. And what you're putting in there is the label of a state in some basis. So, for example, in a two-state system, the basis is plus 1/2 and minus 1/2, and that's what you'd put in there. Generally, you're labeling the states with alpha, which generally denotes continuous variable or a Hilbert space, or n, which denotes a discrete set of variables. Now, when you write a bra and a ket, so say you have bra with a beta in it and alpha in the ket, what that is a dot product between those two vectors in some space. What you have to be aware of is that it is not necessarily the case that the bra and the ket have the same basis vectors. So, for example, suppose I have a state alpha, and I write bra with an x in it, and then ket with an alpha in it. X generally denotes the continuous space of x variables. So bra x ket alpha will generally give you the wave function as a function of x. Similarly, bra with a p in it, ket alpha, gives you the wave function as a function of p, momentum, so that the X and P label moment coordinate and momentum space. Then, of course, you know how to sandwich operators in there, and you are probably quite used to writing something like beta in the bra, A as an operator, and then alpha in a ket, as being equal to the integral over some space, psi, function of x, corresponding to beta with a star, a, psi, function of x, corresponding to alpha. That is, in principle, correct, but you should be aware that implicitly, you're sandwiching superpositions of projections of beta and alpha onto the spatial coordinate x in order to be able to write those wave functions. This can trip you up sometimes, and if you're really not familiar with this, the only place I have seen this really adequately represented is in Sakurai's book, and I would recommend carefully reading sections 2.1 to 1.5, where he goes through this in some detail. This is really worth knowing. This is not just formalism. This is really gets into the guts of how the Brockett notation works. As an exercise, and again coupling on to the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, think about a Gaussian wave packet. And I'm going to assume that this corresponds to, you know, some state alpha. So, cat alpha. If I then project this into the x-coordinate, so I have bra x cat alpha, that's going to be 1 over the 4th root of pi times the square root of d times the exponential of e to the ikx minus x squared over 2d squared. That corresponds to a Gaussian wave, Gaussian profile. And what you should do is carefully using the Brockett notation, calculate the expectation value of x, calculate the expectation of x squared, calculate the expectation value of delta x squared, which is equal to the expectation value of x squared minus the expectation value of x quantity squared. Do the same for p, so calculate the expectation value of p. That's just the de Broglie relation. The expectation value of p squared and the expectation value of delta p squared. And what you should be able to show is that delta p squared, or that delta p times, or delta p squared times delta x squared is equal to h bar squared over 4, which corresponds to the Heisenberg uncertainty relation exactly. You should then go ahead and project the Gaussian packet alpha onto momentum space and make sure you understand what that looks like. If you can do this, and being careful to, you know, insert all of the sums over superpositions of projections onto x and p, then you should really have confidence that you understand how to use this notation properly. Moving on with wave mechanics, the propagation of a particle in free space in one dimension is just minus h bar squared over 2m d squared psi dx equals e psi. And you should be able to insert this into boundary value problems, reflection and transmission problems. So you have a potential that's equal to 0 for x less than 0 and equal to v at v greater than 0 and a wave incident from the left, from the minus x direction. You should be able to calculate the reflected and transmitted coefficients and keep in mind that the reflected and transmission probabilities are going to be equal to those things squared, and you should practice working through that relatively quickly. Of course, you should be able to work out the particle in an infinite square well and work out 2, 3, or 4 non-interacting particles in an infinite square well. For a finite square well, and that's a square well where v is equal to 0 for the absolute value of x smaller than a, and v is equal to v naught for the absolute value of x greater than some small a, you should be able to work out the condition for a bound ground state and a bound first excited state. There's a whole class of problems where you have two square wells that are near each other and the particle is initially in one, and you calculate the tunneling probability to the other square well. Of course, the energy is less. So you should really know how to do one-dimensional bound state problems pretty well. So here are a couple of exercises. First of all, just consider a Dirac delta function potential at the origin. So this is V of x equals some A times Dirac delta x. Calculate the bound states and the energy of the bound states. And then there's the Kronig-Penney model, where the potential is V of x is equal to A times D, well, the sum over N of A times Dirac delta of x minus N times A. So this is a repeating series of Dirac delta functions along the x-axis, spaced A apart. Calculate the bound states, and basically use Bloch's theorem to show what the ground state has to look like. That's a pretty straightforward problem. Dealing with the Dirac delta function is a little bit tricky, and you should keep in mind the definition of the Dirac delta function is that the integral of dx from minus infinity to plus infinity is equal to zero, and the integral of dx over any interval that does not include zero is equal to zero. You need to use that in the theorem of integral calculus to be able to solve those problems. There's also a whole slew of one-dimensional bound state problems where various perturbations are introduced. And we'll talk a little bit about how to handle those in the next podcast, but it's first-order linear perturbation theory, and you should be pretty comfortable with that. So, for example, think about a problem where there's an infinite square well, and you have two particles, two non-interacting particles in the square well of equal mass. So part one is to label all of the states of the two particles and show which ones are degenerate. And the next thing that happens is you introduce a perturbation, which is just a delta function perturbation at the origin, lambda delta of x, and calculate the first few states and see what degeneracies are lifted by the perturbation. Going back to operator mechanics, you should be able to, for the square well problems, classify all of the states by parity. So parity is the change of x to minus x, and wave functions can be parity odd, parity even, or not be parity eigen, not be eigenvalue functions of the parity operator. A function's parity even if it doesn't change when you swap x to minus x, and parity odd if it acquires a minus sign when you make that switch. So here's a little problem. In order to show that in order to measure the measure parity violation, that you must measure the expectation value of a pseudoscalar observable or a pseudoscalar operator. In this class of one-dimensional problems, there's also the WKB approximation and closely related the Sommerfeld quantization. Both of these things are very easy to execute by working a problem. I mean, when working the problem, they generally rely on easy integrals. It does rely on you remembering some constants, and I think you should be able to assume that if you need them, the correct constants will be given, particularly for the WKB approximation. The next thing is the whole class of angular momentum. And to start with, before you even think about angular momentum, you should be sure that you understand how the rotation matrices work and how the generators that generate rotations work, particularly for a spin one-half system. This is just done in the same way you understood translation operators and momentum operators, and that the momentum operator is the generator of spatial translations. Similarly, the angular momentum operator is the generator of spatial rotations, and you should be familiar with the infinitesimal operator, which would be, for example, for a rotation around the z-axis, would be 1 minus I sigma z divided by 2, acting on some wave function. To build up a finite rotation, you would apply that repeatedly n times. So I'm sorry, I misstated that. It would be 1 minus I sigma z delta phi divided by 2 applied to a wave function. To build up a rotation around the angle phi, what you would do would be apply that operator n phi and identify n times delta phi with phi, and then take the limit as n goes to infinity. And then from there, you should be able to build up the rotation operator. So take that as an exercise. And you should pretty much, well, if you work the problems enough, you'll know the rotation matrices for spin one-half, and you should be able to work them out for spin one systems quickly. I wouldn't bother with anything larger than spin one. For the next part, the angular momentum, quantum mechanical angular momentum, this starts with the Schrodinger equation. So the Hamiltonian is minus h bar squared over 2m del squared phi plus v times phi. For an eigenvalue equation, that would be equals e phi. Now, the angular momentum comes out from the separation in a spherical coordinate system of the Schrodinger equation into three equations, one for r, one for theta, and one for phi. And the angular parts, theta and phi, are characterized by the spherical harmonics, y theta and phi, which are 0, 0, 1, 0, 1 plus or minus 1, are the ones you should probably just know. Those are the three lowest for spins, for orbital angular momentum, 0, and then angular momentum 1 that has three substates. Those aren't hard to figure out. You should not spend time practicing how to separate the variables, memorizing how to get del squared into spherical coordinates. You're just not going to be asked to do that. You should know how it works, and you should know what the resulting radial equation looks like, because that's frequently the only interesting thing that you need to solve. In addition, you don't need to memorize Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. What you should know is that the spherical harmonics form an orthogonal system of functions, and you should know how to manipulate that and how to carry out integrals in the general case with 2 and 3 angular momentum functions corresponding to the normalization problem and the problem where you have an angular momentum dependent operator. And then given a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, you should know what to do with it. So a couple of problems along these lines deal with the radial equation, which is frequently the most interesting thing. So, for example, suppose the potential corresponds to a spherical shell. So this is a potential that's equal to zero for r less than zero for r less than a, and infinite for r greater than a. Find the radial wave functions and find the allowed angular momenta. And for the lowest wave function, calculate the pressure on the potential on the surface of the shell as a function of a, and see if there is a minimum, see if there is some radius for a given mass and energy of wave function that that shell wants to be. This is akin to the MIT bag model, which is a model of nuclei developed by Ken Johnson and Bob Jaffe. It's known as the MIT bag model and got a lot of mileage understanding the most basic ideas of mesons and baryons. Carry out the same calculation with a delta function at the origin potential. I'm in fact not totally sure that that works out, but it's an interesting exercise. Now, you should be good at using the symmetry arguments for the angular momentum to very quickly calculate expectation values for different wave functions. One that you very frequently want to know is the expectation value, for example, in hydrogen between the 2p and 1s. You want to know the expectation value of r or of x for a transition between the 2p and 1x, 1s wave functions. So be sure you know how to do that. So another thing, and we'll dwell on this more later on, is including interactions with the electromagnetic field in the Schrodinger equation. Now, of course, the electromagnetic field comes in when we talk about static fields, and including the interaction of a dipole by adding a mu dot b term, or a static electric field, which we characterize with the potential. If we want to talk about something more complicated, for example, some dynamics where there's actually an electron moving in a magnetic field, we have to make use of the canonical momentum. And that just has to do with, going back to classical mechanics, when one includes in the Lagrangian for a free particle, the interaction with the electromagnetic field, the momentum canonically conjugate to the vector x is p minus e squared over c times the vector potential a. Via the correspondence principle, that goes right over into operators. And so, since the Schrodinger equation is p squared over 2m plus vr, the p squared turns into p plus e squared, or p minus e squared over a squared. And this allows us to consider the motion of an electron in a constant magnetic field via Landau levels. And this allows, actually at a rather elementary level, the calculation of the quantum Hall effect. You don't need to go through that calculation, but as an exercise, you should make the substitution I just described, and for a single electron, find the subsequent of the motion of the electron, and show that the electron does in fact couple to the magnetic field. So you need to work out the vector potential corresponding to a magnetic field along Z, and in the absence of any electric field, show that the electron does in fact interact, or find the eigenvalues or eigenfunctions of the electron describing the electron's motion in the magnetic field. There is also the coupling with the radiation field, in that A becomes time-dependent and, in fact, quantized, and so A becomes a superposition over all momenta or frequencies of A sub N, where the sum is carried over N, E to the kx minus omega n, omega sub n, k sub n x minus omega sub n t. And that's just the second quantized electromagnetic field. And one can then calculate transition for any quantum mechanical system by using that as a perturbation to the basis vector, a quantum mechanical system. And we'll work through the example of that in the hydrogen atom next week. But a good exercise is to start with Fermi's golden rule. Okay, so we're going to talk about some system that's kind of unspecified. So there's some system, and it's got a perturbing potential, which we'll just call V. So Fermi's golden rule says that the transition probability of transition per unit time is equal to 2 pi divided by h bar times the probability, or the amplitude of transition squared times the density of states, which for discrete system is just going to be the delta function of the energy difference between the two systems. Start with that and take the perturbation to be time dependent of the form lambda e to the I omega t. Make the dipole approximation and take the lowest order. So the dipole approximation is just the expansion of e to the I omega t term by term. I'm sorry. So start with Fermi's golden rule, which is h bar over 2 pi times the perturbation squared times the delta function of the energy difference, and take the perturbing potential as lambda e to the I omega t, and assume there are two states with En and Ei, and work out the transition probability between those two states, and then use that to prove detailed balance, which is that the emission rate for state I to go to state N divided by the density of final states, number of N states there are, is equal to the absorption rate for N to go to I divided by the density of final states for I. And this is going to rely on you being able to identify admission and absorption in the machinery that comes out. This is a two-state system, and we'll talk much more about that next time. So what we've done thus far is really just talked about the basic ideas, which are the operator mechanics, wave mechanics, things like that. This is kind of a potpourri in quantum mechanics, and it's not really a very coherently developed theory the way classical mechanics or electricity and magnetism is. And it relies on you kind of understanding all of these things individually and being able to put them together. So you need to spend some time thinking about the real meaning of the uncertainty principle, particularly regarding measurement, the wave mechanics, why superposition works, and de Broglie's ideas, and being able to move backwards and forth between them. And the basis for all of this is the Dirac bracket notation. And you've really got to make sure that you understand that pretty well, because it's easy to make a hash out of things if you don't do well with that.
A candy-colored clown, they call the Sandman, tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I go away.
So in the past week, there were some sort of interesting things. Last week, I mentioned the breakthrough of the year in Science Magazine, the proof of the Poincaré conjecture by Grigory Perelman, who's this reclusive Russian mathematician. There's a long piece in the New Yorker magazine called Manifold Destiny about some of the politics surrounding this. In particular, the machinations of a Chinese mathematician named Yao, who has appointments both at Harvard and in China, and how he's trying to step over a Perelman and get credit for this in some complicated way. It's a nice little article, and it has some good descriptions about exactly what the Poincaré conjecture is and how it was proved, in particular some pretty good gossip. You can get this at newyorker.com, and then there's a little search book. Just search on Yao, Y-A-U, and Harvard, and you'll be able to, it'll be the third or fourth hit. The other thing in the science breakthrough issue is a little thing, breakdown of the year, which catalogs the incidences of scientific fraud in the past year, including this fellow Huang in Korea. If you followed this story, he basically just faked a bunch of data involving stem cell research and cloning, and in addition harvested eggs from his research associate, which they did voluntarily, but which you're not supposed to do. And there are things pertaining to financial mismanagement and so on. He became a national hero in Taiwan after, or in Korea after this work, and could fly anywhere on Korea Air and had his picture on a postage stamp. And then the whole thing tanked, partly because some astute observers at Science noticed that he had copied figures. You really wonder about these guys who do stuff like this. You know, you look at it, and it's just inevitable they get caught. And, you know, why? Why do they do it? I don't know. It's not even very interesting. I wouldn't call it a breakthrough, but the other thing that's getting a lot of press is the continuing failure to understand high-TC superconductivity. I don't think this is particularly bad, but it's getting a lot of mention. Probably some of you are working on that, so this is still seems like a pretty hot field to work on. There is a little article on new kinds of disk drives that will have a terabit of storage per square inch. Right now it's some hundreds of gigabits, but terabit opens the door to even higher densities. I don't know what we're going to do with all this disk space. Presumably something. But it's an interesting piece of physics, how disk storage works, and that's in science in the news focus section. Another interesting little thing in this week's science is a retraction of several, I think five, papers by a guy named Jeffrey Chang. This guy is apparently a real hotshot biologist type, and did some really, really important work as a student at Scripps, and was a presidential early career recipient and all of that. And he retracted these papers because apparently the software that he used to process data that he got, crystallography data from some DNA samples, swapped two columns, leading to essentially rendering the results from these two papers completely bogus. Now, this is actually in terms of time and effort, a small error to fix. But these are publications which are being retracted, and he'll have to go and do it again, and it'll get refereed again and then published. Just a little cautionary tale. I mean, that this happens. Two columns of data just got swapped. The article ends with Chang, meanwhile, has been reanalyzing his original data and expects to submit papers on the corrected structures soon. The new structures, quote, make a ton of sense, end quote, biologically, he says. Quote, a lot of things we couldn't figure out before are now very clear, end quote. This may not sound like a big deal, but it's in fact a huge deal. If you look in the letters section, there's a letter from him formally retracting the papers, and you know, this will show up on any CV or anything, and it's a nightmare. It is his fault. It's not a venial sin, but it's certainly a bad mistake. And this does happen. So that's it for this week. Happy New Year. Next week we'll do the hydrogen atom and then two state systems. So send any questions or comments to fisherp@mit.edu, or there's a place where you can post comments on the website. Keep it up. This is now the time to really start working hard. Make sure that your advisor and colleagues know what you're doing, when to expect you and when not to expect you. And make sure you really, I find it really useful just to really set aside a time and place to do this. So if you're just starting, you know, set up a desk somewhere or put a sign on your door or whatever, so that when you're studying, you're really studying and not getting interrupted or surfing the web or things like that. So as always, many thanks to Sheila Marston and her husband John for all the nice work on the website. Hopefully we'll be distributed through iTunes pretty soon. We're reviewing the web content. And thanks to Bonna Newman and Homer Reed from us. And thanks to John Thompson and Maynard Galinas from the LNF Computing Facility for providing this space, and so on. So, Happy New Year, and enjoy the start of the new year here in Cambridge or wherever you are.